All right. Well, as JP said a minute ago, this is meant to be not so much a formal presentation as it is sort of an interactive discussion. So I have prepared PowerPoint slides, mostly just to keep me on topic so I don't ramble too much, and also to give you guys some multimedia fun as part of this presentation, since we are talking about media. But feel free to jump in, ask questions, you know, if something doesn't strike you as right, or if, you know, if you want to discuss something or you have a question about something. So I want to open the dialogue up right away. So the topic of my talk is Asia at the Cutting Edge, and I put the question mark after it because it seems that there's always this assumption that Asia, especially recently in the last few years, that Asian technology providers and Asian markets and the Asian entertainment industry is, in a sense, at the cutting edge of technological developments, especially in digital media. There's a quote from the CEO of BBC Worldwide that he gave last year at the CASBAH conference, which is the cable and satellite of Asia, whatever, companies of Asia conference. And he said, "Today, Asia leads the world in so many aspects of digital technology, it's no exaggeration at all to say the world is now watching you meaning Asia, and we all have a great deal to learn from the experience." And so you always hear people talk about this and talk about how Asia's at the cutting edge and how we have so much to learn from Asia in the West, but you never really hear people articulate whether Asia actually is at the cutting edge, why Asia could be considered at the cutting edge, and what, in fact, we do have to learn from Asia in its trials and tribulations developing markets for digital media. If there is, in fact, anything to learn at all. So what's all the excitement about in Asia? Well, when you get right down to it, most of it seems really to revolve around this idea that Asian economies, especially Japan, South Korea, China, Taiwan, are really high-rate tech adopters. So, you know, you and I think a lot of this comes from sort of the stereotypical image in the West of the Asian kids with all the latest gadgets, you know, and the Asian technophile mentality, and that's true to some extent. I mean, it's true that Asia tends to adopt technology at a higher rate. So, for example, when you talk about digital media in Asia, you really see that the Asian economies have adopted digital media sort of right out of the gate. I mean, there hasn't been any lag time at all. People have talked about how China essentially leapfrogged the whole CD the whole CD market and essentially went straight to digital. You know, Chinese young people essentially had no qualms at all about jumping right into finding music on the internet. It just sort of instantly became second nature as soon as that stuff was available. In South Korea, for example, I mean, a few statistics. I don't want this to become a statistical alphabet soup, this presentation, but I mean, just a few statistics. South Korea has the highest broadband adoption rate in the world at about 62% of households, and in fact, the broadband speed is higher in Korea than it is in the U.S. So you have these sort of highly connected societies in Korea, in Japan, in China increasingly now. There's over 65 million broadband subscribers in China, and I believe that surpasses the U.S. Is that right?
if you draw the broadband growth curves, 07 is where China passes.
It's
close, actually. And and China is definitely growing faster.
Yes. Yeah.
Because of the law of small numbers there.
Exactly. Yeah. So the number that gets content providers really excited is the 400 million. It's an amazing number. More than 400 million mobile phone subscribers now in China alone. Of course, in South Korea, there's tremendous adoption. Taiwan.
That's 30%, right? 400 million,
roughly.
Nothing with India. India is outside.
India. You know, the thing about India is India is adopting technology at a high rate. But you don't see in the entertainment fields. You don't see quite the level of like the digital media adoption that you see in other parts of Asia yet in India.
The
movie industry is tremendously successful, but in terms of sort of, you know, the online music space and everything, people aren't talking too much about India. They talk mostly about, you know, South Korea, China, Taiwan,
the wireless.
Even Japan actually is not sort of at the, if you will, the cutting edge of the sort of digital, the growth and the development of the digital media markets, the online and the handset download markets. Now, I mean, in Japan, it's incredibly popular. To I think something like 92% of some huge number, 92% or something of music sales now are done through handsets, or digital music sales are done through handsets. But actually, the market's declining in Japan overall. The overall sort of music entertainment market is on the decline.
Is it being substituted by something identifiable?
Yeah, I don't know exactly what accounts for the decline, but one thing that's interesting is sort of even online piracy has never been as big an issue in Japan as it has in some other countries. One of the reasons is because in Japan, Japan's one of the few countries that legally allows you to rent CDs, right? So people basically just rent CDs, rip them, and then, you know, and they don't have to go online to do the file sharing and that sort of thing. So that sort of changes the picture in Japan.
That would still be considered a form of digital piracy.
Right. Right. I mean,
large investments in bandwidth
and user. Right. The result may be similar, but they actually. Right.
Right.
So in Japan, Japan's having declining birth rate, right? They have a bit of a baby bust.
Yeah,
coming.
That could be
so
part of the demographic.
Part of your market problem is that you don't have as many teenagers who, right, ringtones are not.
They're taking over.
I think that's probably part of it. And also, you know, you've got so many competing technologies now, and you've got so many things competing for the consumer's disposable income. So, you know, especially things like video game. I mean, gaming is huge, obviously, and that sort of thing in Japan. So,
You're separating games from.
Yes, because I'm talking mostly about music at this point.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I'm actually. My talk is going to be sort of biased toward music overall in this sense because. Because the gaming industry, I mean, that's just sort of a whole different.
Yeah, but
that's,
it overlaps. I mean,
it totally overlaps.
You can't, right? Okay.
It totally overlaps, but in terms of, I mean, the gaming industry doesn't have the same kinds of problems that the content industries have. So, for example, the gaming industry doesn't deal with the piracy problem for the most part.
Well,
they have. Certainly they have, you know, like piracy of CD-ROMs and things of games but where the real growth in gaming is in online gaming, and that's really difficult to pirate, obviously, because you have central control of the online gaming system, right?
We have a lot of concerns about sort of the there's theft of points and identities in the gaming world being sold, and this currency is being created to do that, that actually is a big issue and is a forerunner of how, I mean, arguably, how things are going to go in other industries. But if you see the gaming industry is a forerunner of where the media industry is going to go, you would argue that. Because the growth rates and the environment's being created, that a lot of the problems you're having there, you can see elsewhere. And so that it creates all.
So you don't think those are pretty specific to the gaming industry? I mean, things like
no, because I think you're going to find other forms of entertainment are going to be created. The whole idea of creating a media and using end user tools to create entertainment media and share it, and then the property issues around that become something that's is going to be something you anticipate. And so, I think that's where it's going to go, arguably.
You the 21st?
Yeah, that's right. That's solid, right? Actually, we're doing that. I mean, creating the whole idea is to create tools that allow you to create new kind of music. I mean, we're going to on the 21st, we're doing mashup of different music.
Mm-hmm.
Make it license free and have people vote on it and assign points, reputation systems, and create an ecosystem for great new kind of entertainment.
Well, I mean, you're certainly right that there is a tremendous amount of crossover now between the two, and you certainly see, like, for example, in China now. The biggest online gaming provider, Shanda, is basically getting into the e-music business, you know, and they're integrating that into their game system, and they're using sort of their massive consumer base. I think they just struck a deal with EMI Records or something to include their music in there, and I think actually sell downloads of their music through their system and that sort of thing. So, but I see that in a sense. I mean, at this point, I'm still looking at that as, you know, as a way for content providers to access their audience and to, you know, sort of create new channels for distribution and that kind of thing. But
I don't want to throw you out, but there's the argument that you're going to have your users, your members, are their own content.
Right, and I'll talk about that.
Okay, all
right. Right, exactly.
It introduces another set of ownership models, distribution models.
Absolutely, okay. Absolutely.
And how channels are created. Okay.
Right. So, absolutely, yeah, and I'll talk about that. So I think that another reason why there's sort of all this excitement around Asia is because everybody's looking for sort of the killer app, if you will, or the killer model that will defeat piracy, which is a huge problem in significant parts of Asia. And China especially is really sort of the 800-pound gorilla in this sense. And so everybody is looking to the new technologies as a way of sort of creating that magic bullet to defeat the piracy problem. So that's, I think, another reason why everybody's looking at Asia. Now, of course, you've got online piracy, you know, or if you don't want to use such a controversial and charged term, you know, sort of file sharing, unauthorized downloading going on all over the world, and people are wondering, is the solution to that going to be found in Asia, in one of the business models that sort of develops in Asia? So right now, sort of along these lines, mobile distribution is really what people are talking about. I mean, if you want to get a major label record executive's pacemaker all in a flutter, mention mobile downloads in Asia, and that gets people excited. Talk about internet downloading in Asia, and you're not going to get much of a
flutter.
Yeah, right. So, but talk about mobile downloading, and you're going to get a response. And one of the main reasons is that it's monetizable. So, whereas online downloads, they've had trouble sort of figuring out a model that works and it's sustainable. But with mobile, you know, you've got this massive installed customer base. You know, again, in China, you've got 400 million mobile users. You've got one of the big issues is you've got the secured established billing, so that you can essentially use the mobile phone as a surrogate for a credit card or something like that. Did you have a question?
Yes, what's the penetration of 3G? Or where is that?
3G is sort of in China is set to come online in 2007 in a big way.
Okay, anyway.
So it's not really, 3G is not a major factor there right now yet at this point. But it is, like in South Korea, it is.
What's 3G?
Oh, so 3G is like, stands for third generation mobile mobile phone technology. So
yeah.
John can probably explain it better than
me. But there's also 3G, post-3G, and then it's quasi-broadband. It's what, 384, what is it, kilobits? It's reasonable size, so we're doing downloads and video.
Right.
But then there's another version out running quickly that's it's almost...
It's 4G.
It's
4G. I don't think it's called 4G. It's
I think 3.1G, but you know.
But it is significant in that it's close to a megabit or something like that, which then you're in a whole another game.
Yeah.
Right,
and it becomes a whole different kind of.
So then you can do you can literally do like over
video.
The air,
yeah
like live.
So what stuff we're doing here? I mean, it becomes a very different. Yeah.
Right, right, exactly. So especially like the video
right.
producers, that sort of thing, they're really excited about this, and they they view this as this is sort of the magic bullet they think in Asia mobile. They think this is really going to. Turn the tide because it's got the hip factor. It's something that's they find that there's a pretty high rate of interest in, pretty high rate of adoption, and
wow.
Again, like I said, you can provide a completely secure platform to the content providers, theoretically anyway, that would allow them to monetize massive market for downloads and for streaming, all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Is the piracy rate? I would think the piracy rate for mobile downloading would be almost as good if people can just if they can just take from peer to peer on the internet and just put it on their phone.
You know, so it is a problem, and mobile downloaders have, the mobile providers, right? The mobile phone companies that are hooking up with record companies to provide download services and that kind of thing are bemoaning this right now. I mean, they're saying this is, you've got to clean up the piracy market in order for us to really realize the potential. Well, that's always the thing, right? I mean, is it the government? Is it the responsibility of the content producers themselves to sort of go out and police this stuff?
But what's happened? This is why another pushing ad for the concept of identity layer is coming in. So you're having, say, Liberty Alliance and everything that, and there's going to be sort of a uniform identity layer going on the mobile platform to be the same for PC. And then you're going to have the ability to authenticate users and create different kinds of sign-ons and all sorts of networks within networks.
Right. So the question is it?
This is one format of trying. This is a technological format of trying to correct it.
Well, right. It's policy too. I mean, it'll be baked in. I mean, there's a lot behind it. For good or for ill.
It's a hypothesis that it'll be baked in.
Microsoft is releasing it, and now I know Qualcomm's going to be behind this too. And so, there are a lot of big players who are overlaying it and tying into the whole the financial transaction side. So I think bet something is going to take.
Okay. Well, I'm gonna move on because. One of the things that really is exciting to the copyright owners is the idea of how mobile phones allow, because personal accessory now, especially in Asia. I mean, they've done studies now where I think they've asked, I don't remember if it was teenagers in Korea or Japan, like how long can you be away from your mobile phone without feeling anxiety or something? And the average was like 3 minutes or something. It's just, it's really a part of the culture, and it's a form of expression, right? I mean, not just what phone you have, but what what your phone does when it rings or something. So there's this kind of realization that. Music is an expression not only of the creator, but also of the audience, right? It's a form of the audience, a form of expression on the audience's part as well. And you can identify yourself to others by the kind of music that you listen to. You know, this is who I identify with. You know, when you call me, my phone rings, you know, and it plays Zeppelin, and that tells you something about me or whatever, you know. So ringtones are a really, really important part of the revenue stream in Asia now. And something else which began in South Korea and moved to, is huge in China now, is something called ring back tones, which is essentially like hold music. When you call somebody's phone, you know, the same thing, because, you know, you want to be able to express yourself to the people around you, right, by the track that's playing when your phone rings. But you also want to be able to express yourself to the person who's calling you. And so the person who's calling you, instead of hearing the standard brr, brr, right, in the phone, they hear your favorite song or whatever the biggest, you know, your favorite song that week or whatever. And now, you know, there are different kinds of ringtones, right? There are master tones, which are actual samples, you know, digital recordings of the songs that will play on your phone. There are sort of the traditional ringtones, which are like monophonic tones. There are polyphonic ringtones. So there are all these ways for copyright owners to unbundle the copyright in their work and monetize it in different ways. And that's exciting to them with regard to mobile phones. In fact, things like ringtones, ringback tones have accounted for the vast majority of copyright owners' digital revenues in Asia, much more than, say, online downloading or even, you know, mobile downloading. I mean, it's really about ringtones and ringback tones.
For the ringback tones, nobody's doing commercials, are they?
It's a good question. Like, so you
product placements.
Yeah, like,
that's a good question.
Like, somebody says, you can have free service if you play. Oh,
I don't know, but this is being podcast, and somebody will start doing it now, I guarantee you. You just came up with a great idea.
The CRTC, like 6 years ago, someone called me and asked me if that was legal, if they could buy the airtime when someone was on hold. Or for the legal department.
I should clarify, when I say it's hold music, it's not actually when somebody puts you on hold, but in fact, it's just when the phone is ringing.
When you're waiting for first.
Yeah, it's literally you call somebody's phone and a song starts playing, and it'll play until they answer the phone. So this idea of ringback tones, master tones, things, they allow you to re-monetize the song over and over again in different ways. The more ways you can break it up, the more ways you can think to sell the song, the more money you can make from that song. So this is just a snapshot that I pulled from somebody else's PowerPoint at a conference, and I meant to
various.
Yeah, right. I meant to cite them there, but so exactly, that's exactly what it is. This is the digital black market right here. In essence, this is what you can see happening in Korea from 2001 to 2007. You see the offline market is declining. That's basically the CD market. The black market for digital music, you know, sort of spiked in 2005. And then they predict that it's going to drop by two-thirds by 2007. I'm not sure where that optimism comes from, but that's sort of this is a company involved in music and music distribution and telecom. So it might be self-serving.
Estimate to get
the
big shit.
Right.
That was off.
Yeah, this is the company involved in the Blue Line.
Exactly. This is a Blue Line company.
Who do you want to serve?
Company called Wider.
Coincidentally.
So, right, exactly. So this is... Pardon me?
From where?
So it's from a company called Wider Than, which is a... These are statistics from a company called Wider Than, which is a South Korean, like, mobile music and mobile services provider. So, I wanted to contrast this with this, which comes from data by Big Champagne, which is a U.S.-based company that tracks online piracy and sort of tracks how many file shares are online at any given time. And you can see since
again, this is a company that has...
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, so file... Okay, so just file sharing. But it includes illicit file sharing, right? Presumably a big chunk of it is illicit file sharing.
This is a company that makes money based on how fast those lines grow as well. Yeah.
Right, exactly. So
market analyst numbers or
regression analysis tell you that, right?
So obviously they have a different view of where things are headed. Now this is U.S. and global numbers, so maybe the South Korean experience, the South Korean sort of future is different. But this
more
indicates
broadband, less piracy, that sort of thing.
Exactly, more broadband, less piracy.
Isn't the time snapshot actually the same as your prior slide? This cuts off in December
05, right?
Right, because so the time
there
snapshot
the
is not right.
Like in 06.
That's true. Although what I would say, because these are, because they don't have an estimate, right? So, but through through I don't know February or March 2006, this trend has not seemed to be decreasing. I mean, this trend is continuing. So anyway, I mean, I'm not trying to make too big a point of this. I'm just, in a sense, I just wanted to sort of contrast the trend in South Korea versus what seems to be the trend globally, and just sort of point out that either they expect to be doing something right in South Korea, or there might be something wrong with their numbers or these numbers, but in South Korea they're really bullish, okay, about the digital music market, and a lot of this is ringback tones, master tones, that kind of thing. It's not necessarily online, sort of, you know, iTunes style a la carte downloading. So I want to shift the focus a little bit for a minute to China, because in China you have severe online piracy. Essentially, you basically have a situation where, you know, whenever you want to find any track you want, you don't even really need to. I mean, there are peer-to-peer networks and that sort of thing, but you don't even need to bother with those. You can actually just type into your favorite Chinese search engine, the name of the song you want or the artist you want, and it'll provide you with links to thousands of links to unauthorized copies of the file. And so the big search engines are really sort of the bane of the content owners in China. So how right now, since I'm sort of talking about, you know, digital media and Asia at the cutting edge, in China, sort of everybody is really focusing, looking at China because of the severe piracy problem. People are watching with keen interest how China is developing its content industries in order to, you know, to navigate these treacherous waters and come up with potentially a solution to online piracy. So I thought I'd look at a couple of, if you want to call them case studies or whatever, a couple of companies that are sort of taking an all in stride kind of approach to online piracy and figuring out ways to build successful business models around that. And one is Taihe Rai Music, which is one of the most successful domestic Chinese labels. It's a fairly new label, but they basically went straight to digital. They do produce CDs, but even the president of the company will basically tell you that CDs are essentially promotional tools. They're basically souvenirs for the artist. You know, the action is in digital, and the action is in mobile. Essentially, sort of their business strategy is some of these points. They'll only sell music from the most popular singers. They strike a deal with the search engines that I just mentioned, Essentially, what they do with, say, Baidu, which is one of the which is China's biggest search engine, and also probably the biggest offender in terms of online providing these unauthorized links, they basically strike a deal with them and they say, look, we'll give, you know, please just give us a 2-week head start. Make sure that there are no unauthorized links to a new release for the first 2 weeks of the release. And any links you provide should be, you know, should basically send people to our website. And then after 2 weeks, you know, there's not much we can do. You know, you can, I mean, do what you've got to do. Because the truth is that these search engines, a huge percentage, somewhere between 20% and 40% of their traffic is people basically looking for MP3 downloads, and for the most part, unauthorized MP3 downloads. And so these, you know, the Chinese music companies are realistic. They realize they're not going to, you know, these search engines are not going to shut these links down, because they basically be committing suicide. I mean, they'd be cutting out 20% to 40% of their traffic. And of course, they, you know, if Baidu, the major Chinese search engine, were to do that, they'd just be opening the door for Alibaba or Sohu.com or any of the other big Chinese search engines to basically come in and pick up the slack, take up that traffic. And so unless they all do it, unless they all shut down all links, it's just not going to end up benefiting copyright owners in the long run. So basically the copyright owners are you know, striking deals with them and saying, look, give us some lead time. You know, the song, it really has a shelf life of 2 weeks for the most part in China. And so, you know, we'll, you know, just give us that 2-week lead time, and we'll leave you alone. Sure. So Baidu was sued and
in China
and lost in the initial proceeding, right? So in the lowest level court, and they it's being appealed now, but they basically lost. But you know, in China, the thing is that the penalties, I mean, you know, it's basically they can just write it off as the cost of doing business. I mean, right now they just raised the penalties for online piracy. There was just a new regulation that came out within the last couple of days, and it's like $12,000 U.S. Administrative fine. If you know, now in the lawsuit, it's different. It's not an administrative fine, but it's not anything that a company like Baidu is really going to be worried about. I mean, it makes more sense, you know. And the thing is, they're backed in a corner. I mean, because they need the search traffic in order to survive, basically. And the copyright owners aren't giving them any leeway. So, I mean, Baidu, for example, has gone to the major record companies and said, you know, look, we'll cut you in on part of our search revenue. You know, we'll pay you X number of millions of dollars per year. You know, the major record companies told them to go fly a kite. You know, I mean, they wouldn't have anything, and they wouldn't have any part of that. And, you know, that's... you know, that's sort of the kind of thinking that I think if people want to really have a viable business in China, if you want to have a viable, you know, music business in China, you know, I mean, people are going to have to start thinking about things like that, deals like that, as new ways of generating revenue, and substantial revenue at that.
Kind of interesting. One of the arguments sort of against very strict copyright enforcement here is that, well, free distribution creates buzz, and you have a leading buzz period, and then people will buy it just because of market inertia, or they'll buy it for some reason. Whereas this is saying the exact opposite, that you're going to get a very front-heavy revenue model. Now is that because they're very different forms? How do you get people interested in the song in the first place?
That's a great point. I mean, you know, and it is true. I'll talk about it in a minute how, I mean, in China, more than just about anywhere else, I mean, artists have really been able to ride the wave of piracy and do very, very well. The record companies have not, but the artists have you know, there are a lot of artists who've really benefited from both physical piracy and online piracy.
By gaining revenue through live performances.
Exactly. So they you know, and actually record companies, I mean, that's sort of one of my bullet points here is this idea of bundling music products with services. You know, I mean, that's how record companies, and especially artists in China, really make money, is they through live performances, through product promotions, through, you know, deals with online gaming companies, things like that.
But doesn't that change the equation and the bargaining power of the artists go up? I mean,
that's it does. And in fact, artists in China have basically, their artists have said, what do I need a record company for? You know, I'm just going to go straight to these online digital providers.
And that's true here as well as there, except they're more entrenched interests here. So, I mean, that just strikes me as if you want to see whether the wind's blowing.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. And in fact, I was at a music business conference in Hong Kong several weeks ago, and there was a famous Hong Kong artist named Edison Chen who did just that. I mean, he left his major label record company and just started putting his music online for free. And he said he's never been more successful and he's never been happier. And he's a major artist there. So, I mean, you know, and he, you know, now he controls his artistic decisions. Now he controls, you know, all the money comes to him. He can decide who he cuts promotional deals with and things like that. And that's where he makes a lot of his money, through live performances, right, through promotional deals, and basically gives music away. So,
that's like Jake Shapiro's story, too.
Yeah, so, I mean, right. I mean, that's, that's, it's definitely happening more and more. One of the interesting things, too, is what you find is with these record companies like Taihe, one of the things they do, which is different from, say, U.S.-based or the big transnational record companies, is that they, when they sign an artist, they sign them to basically do everything. They sign them as their manager, they sign them as their music publisher, they sign them as their record company. They basically go into sort of a full-fledged partnership with the artist and say, look, we're in this together, we're going to make money any way we can, and we're going to make money together. Now, one of the interesting and I think positive sort of results that come, aspects of that is that one of the things it allows them to do is they own all the rights in-house. Unlike in the U.S. where you have one publishing company that owns the rights to songs and a record company that owns the rights to the recording and all, makes licensing a nightmare, especially in the digital world. Well, these companies, they're lean and mean. I mean, they can license things in 5 minutes over the phone because they own all the rights to everything. They can, and it really, I mean, that in a way really benefits the artist. I mean, if you want to talk about where the cutting edge is in Asia, where things are heading, I mean, I think that's one of the things that Western entertainment companies really have to learn, is that you need to keep the rights more consolidated, and you need to be, more lean and mean in terms of how you license your rights, be more aggressive about licensing them.
But doesn't that the torpedo, though, sort of the whole Western model, the whole idea of life? I mean, this is right at the judgment. I'm not sure that they can really adapt to that and be what they are.
They're going to have to, in my view. But,
or something else. It's going to be, it's a disruption.
Right. But I mean, that's the thing. You know, people talk about in Asia how, it can take weeks or months to get the license for a digital download. When you deal with the majors, but then when you deal with the domestic labels, you can get them over the phone in 5 minutes.
From a whole policy point of view, I mean, you have the sort of U.S. taking positions on what is privacy and what is property, and feeling they're having to protect an industry. So you're really protecting a certain manifestation. And
right.
It's very archaic, and from an industrial policy, shouldn't be supported.
Exactly.
This is a more efficient model.
It's very brutal. It's not a model that can coexist with a set of artists.
It's going to create more value. And it's more equitable. And it's just
whatever. Are there any Western artists who are wanting to go with them instead?
Yeah. I don't think they sign Western artists.
They don't?
No, they might distribute some Western artists for like major labels or something, but I think they just sign Chinese artists. And as I said, they're really, it's really focused on the hit the hit stuff. I mean, these are that's one issue. These are hit factories, and that's how they make their money. I mean, these are not, you know, there's not a lot of experimental stuff going on at these companies in terms from an artistic standpoint.
Is this just China, or are you going to see this is this model being replicated and imitated?
In South Korea, I'm less familiar with the business models of the record companies in South Korea, but I think that they're closer to this, but they're not quite here. Whereas in Japan, you have more sort of the traditional Western style, record companies. Although the newer companies are all kind of getting it and they're changing. Another example is this company called Jinwen, which is the second largest record company, domestic label in China. And basically, one of the things that they're really doing is they're really taking advantage of, John, you were talking a little bit ago about consumer-created content, right? Well, they basically put up a website, their website, and their web portal invites anybody to upload their content and sort of create a community around it. But think about it. I mean, because this is like a major Chinese record label. Think about from a business model standpoint. Think about if EMI or Warner Brothers were to start a web portal and basically say, hey, bands, artists, whatever, upload your content. And we'll make it available to everybody online. And the artists that get the top downloads, sort of the best artists online, will sign you to a record deal because that's what this company does.
What MySpace?
MySpace, exactly.
It's moving in that direction. Where is that direction?
I mean, but MySpace, you know, the difference with MySpace is, you know, MySpace basically started as like a community portal,
right.
and then people were like, "Hey, we can use it to promote our music," and so it kind of.
But now it is a distribution channel for music.
But now it is a distribution channel.
Yeah, it's very self-consciously.
Exactly, but
and a creator. Okay.
But you know, and it's very and when you think about who could compete with MySpace, it's hard to imagine anyone really being able to compete with MySpace because that's where everyone is. But if anyone could you imagine, though, if, like, you know, Warner Brothers or EMI or somebody basically put up a music, you know, just with that branding power and basically put up a music portal? Well,
and so is that their revenue models?
I mean, in a sense, it's kind of like an online American Idol, right? I mean, it's like, you know, upload lots and lots of music and the most popular stuff will sign to a record deal, you know. It's sort of, and it's a way for us to do our artist and repertoire work. It's a way for us to sift out the outstanding, you know, artists. And they have, as it says here, a catalog of over 20,000 user submitted songs. I mean, that's also from their standpoint. That's a huge, because basically people are providing them with a license to, you know, to distribute 20,000 songs, and they've come to, you know, as JP mentioned earlier, I'm working on the DMX project, which is a Berkman-initiated project where we're basically looking to set up in lots of territories around the world a legalized peer-to-peer distribution system, subscription-based distribution system for digital content. And basically, Jingwen approached us and said, look, we've got all this content. You know, is this something you might be interested in? So, you know, this is a kind of a tremendous potential revenue generator for them. They've, you know, it's this huge catalog of songs. So, I mentioned user-created content. This is... this is a phenomenon in China. I'm going to sort of scroll through a few different...
Here as well.
Okay, so people... All right, so I didn't realize people are familiar with... But, so these guys are basically, you know, a couple of college kids, including the guy playing Doom in the background, who's a member of the band, and all he does is play Doom in the background. You know, these guys, they basically just, you know, filmed this with their webcam, uploaded it online, became an overnight sensation in China.
Isn't
No, but Motorola is. And Motorola signed them on as spokesperson. people, because Motorola basically said, hey, look, you know, they, you know, this is what kids are into. This is how we can connect to the young people. So, you know, and it's related to music and pop culture and everything. So we can promote not only our phones, but Motorola has a music distribution system in China. Basically, they have their own version of iTunes, and they use these guys to promote that. Okay, so that's one example of user-created content, like I said, that's basically a phenomenon. So here's another example. This is an artist named Xiang Xiang, and she was an internet artist. She was basically just discovered by putting her music up on the internet, and she posted this song, which is called Song of Pig. Zhuzhige in Chinese. So this song actually has been allegedly downloaded over 1 billion times, which may make it the most downloaded song in history, I don't know. But those are the lyrics, obviously. Very popular. Yeah. It's a phenomenon. I mean, it was phenomenally successful, phenomenally popular.
What's the secret?
It is not. It's essentially, no, I mean, it's a catchy melody, you know, it's cutesy lyrics, you know, that young people, kids like, young teenage girls like, right? You know what I mean? But this, she became popular essentially I think she wrote this song herself, basically up, you know, sort of did a little MIDI studio version of it, uploaded it online, and it became enormously popular essentially overnight. And then she signed a deal with a production company in Beijing, put out a legitimate copy, a CD, produced it, like a legitimate produced CD copy, and it sold close to 1 million copies, legitimate copies, probably millions and millions more pirated copies. So, you know, it's exactly, you know, it's...
But what is this?
I mean,
I think that...
So, for example, like this version is sort of the post-label produced version. So, you know, I haven't actually heard her original version, but I suspect it just didn't have the excitement of the choral la-las in the background and all that sort of thing, you know, that you get from the professional production. And I think that's where labels... I actually think that in the future you're going to see more... It's going to be... Online is going to be a boon for record producers who can disassociate themselves more from labels, basically, and sign artists or act as hired guns for artists, produce this kind of version of the artist's song, and then...
It's very different getting your marketing piece, but the justification of creating marketing, discovering the artist, then marketing, packaging the artist, deals, and this is... That really reduces that value.
Exactly.
So,
exactly.
I don't see how that business model works anymore.
Exactly. I agree, and that's, again, where I think that, you know... And again, I mean, in the U.S., you have, like, user-created content that's being put online and that sort of thing, but I don't think you've had anything that's had the phenomenal success of these. I mean, these are, you know... I mean, 1 billion downloads. That's incredible. And this also was a phenomenon with young people in China. This guy, Hu Ge, who's a... basically, he's a musician and like an audio equipment salesman from Shanghai, who watched, who went and saw Chen Kaige. Chen Kaige is the director of like Farewell, My Concubine. He went and watched his latest movie, The Promise, and thought it was really crummy and was really disappointed in it. And so he basically went home on his PC, used editing software and a pirated copy of the movie, pirated DVD of the movie, and made his own mashup, exactly, a spoof, not really a spoof of the movie, but just used footage from the movie to create his own satire. And essentially, and this is incredibly popular among young Chinese. And one of the main reasons is because, I think this really signals sort of the advent of an alternative media in China. Because this was not, you have the traditional state-run, state-approved media, right, in China. But this is user-created content that wasn't state-approved. It was just posted online. And it effectively is, it fills a need that doesn't exist. There's no really like Saturday Night Live in China or something, nothing that would poke fun at these kind of guys, the government, sort of approved news commentators and things. This is like The Daily Show meets Monty Python or something. And it fills a need in China that the state-run media hasn't been supplying. So I actually think this more than any sort of user-created content, this movie has the most kind of long-term sort of, if you will, subversive or just sort of generative capability. In this, what's that? Yeah, exactly. If I want to use a Zitrain phrase. But so essentially, I mean, we obviously won't watch the whole thing, but essentially he took this serious movie, The Promise, and turned it into a story about a guy. He talks about how this guy owns like a small-time rec center, and his wife is kind of, she's like a stripper, and they, the owner of the rec center gets killed by a local county clerk over a steamed bun, and then the thing gets, gets crazy and sort of Monty Python-esque, and it's, And again, Chinese people find it hilarious because it keeps sort of reverting back to, this news announcer who's telling the story. It's sort of like this investigative reporting, and then he uses clips from the movie and actually like turns them into ads, and the reporting will break and turn into an ad, it's funny stuff, and it certainly has captured the imagination of the Chinese populace. So, right. So Chen Kaige, the director of this movie, actually sued the creator of this. Did he actually sue? Has he sued him? He threatened to sue him, and there was a huge in the blogosphere in China. There was this huge uproar, and people said, get a sense of humor, Kaige. This is ridiculous. The guy just, he made a funny movie. It's better than yours. Calm down. Apparently, Chen Kaige's wife, or ex-wife, kind of came out and said, yeah, calm down. It's not that big of a deal. right. So, but I don't know if the lawsuits actually happened. And it's really unclear if Hu Ge is sued. It's really unclear whether he would win under Chinese law because, there really has never been a lawsuit to establish whether parody is a form of fair use or not in whether there's a fair use parody defense in China. So anyway, just to kind of wrap up, I just want to talk about briefly sort of if Asia's at the digital cutting edge, how is it at the digital cutting edge? Well, For one thing, I talked about unbundling of digital rights when I talked about ringtones and master tones and things like that. Unbundling of digital rights is one way in which I think that you could say that Asia is ahead of maybe the rest of the world in terms of its realization of how digital works can be monetized, right? Second, the blurring of the line between content creator and consumer. I think that this has happened more in China than probably anywhere else in the world. And China is really just gaga over content creator or consumer-created content, rather. I mean, you saw the videos and the music examples that I just gave. There are many more. There's probably the most popular song in China over the last several years is a song called "Mice Love Rice," which was again an internet song. I think more than at least 50% of the most popular artists in China now got their start as undiscovered artists on the internet. I mean, that's amazing. I don't think there's any other country that can claim that. Blogs are huge in China. I think there's over 30 million personal blogs now in China. They expect by the end of 2007 there will be somewhere around 60 million. So there's this tremendous sort of rush of consumer created content. Of course, you know, there are the governmental controls and the censorship issues involved with that, and that creates kind of a whole other ball of wax that I don't really have time to get into now. But that's obviously part of the picture. But I think in a way it also drives this need for consumer created content for the reasons that Huga's video was so popular. It creates, you know, the sort of more stringent government controls on media really create a need for an underground alternative media, which is not really so underground anymore. It's really, I mean, Huga is more popular than probably just about anybody in the, you know, state-run media, because in sort of the traditional media, because you know, he actually speaks to he speaks to experiences that aren't addressed adequately in the sort of state-run media.
So how would you characterize the new business model that's coming out on media that's coming out of China? How do you make money and user-generated content, and what kind of rights do you need?
Well, I think like what you were talking about, you know, just the idea that the creator is much more empowered in this sense. And I think in China there's sort of this approach that, you know, if you get attention, if you're popular, you know, the money will come, right? I mean, if you have created something that is, you know,
you have the right to do that. It's more enlightened than we have here.
What's that?
It's more enlightened than we have here in terms of basically.
Right. Well, I mean, it's you know, there's much more. So, like that Jingwen record company I mentioned that has the, you know, the web portal that allows you to upload your music, and it kind of, that music then sort of becomes part of the Jingwen family, right? Of artists and that kind of thing. It's sort of opening the doors and saying, look, we want all your stuff. You know, we don't want to just control the distribution channels. We want to connect more closely with not only the creators but with the consumers of content. And that's why, you know, why I said sort of like in the West, you know, that, you know, it'd be incredible to see a company like Warner Brothers or EMI or something sort of do the same thing and open their doors and say, look, you know, upload your music and become part of the Warner Brothers family.
Is that an established record label that already had?
Yes, it's the second largest record company in China traditionally. They're the biggest pop and rock domestic Chinese label.
Because one of the big criticisms that I understand of moving from the physical to online is that the existing companies don't have the same respect or brand, and they almost it gives the opportunity for newer companies to establish street cred. I think about it in the broadcasting context, like a CBS.com isn't going to have the same clout as, well, YouTube's not as big as CES, but there's more opportunity for new cooler companies.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, in a sense, that's why actually they brand their web portal as kook.com, not as Jingwen, you know, uploads.com or something, right? So, but the fact that it's part of the same family, I think, gives it a tremendous amount of credibility. You know, I my point is just if one of the majors were to do that, say in the U.S., were to do something like that, I mean, can you imagine how quickly they would have, you know, hundreds of thousands of bands and artists and things uploading their music there just because of the brand recognition of, you know, that people want to be associated with those brands. Although you're right, they probably would want to sort of spin it with an offshoot label or something that had a hipper vibe. You know, less of an old media vibe to it.
Am I to get you right here and say that the difference between the U.S. companies and the Asian companies are basically giving up on piracy. Essentially just, we can't fight piracy. So what do we do?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure I would say giving up, because I don't think any of them have actually given up, but I think that they recognize the realities of the marketplace and they're able to adapt and sort of work within those realities.
What does DRM look like in Asia? I don't know.
So, for example, I mean, the online music, you know, because there are sort of iTunes-type a la carte online music download stores in China and Hong Kong and throughout Asia, and they pretty much all use Windows, you know, Windows Media DRM. So they use, you know, DRM, but I think Motorola on their online store, they have like a proprietary Motorola DRM because they want to lock you to the Motorola phones, right? But DRM is there, but it's like anywhere else, it doesn't really do much, and it's not a very compelling business model because, you know, basing your hopes for a future business model on how much you can restrict and limit your customers' ability to do the things they want to do is not a very that wouldn't be a, you know, a sales pitch that I would invest in, you know. Right. I mean, so that's the point I'm making here about flexibility and adaptability in business models, this idea that, you know, you go to multiple revenue sources for your, you know, for your revenue. You don't just rely on the revenue you can make through distribution music, but you rely on revenue you can make through live performances. You know, you partner with the artist, you have a broader perspective on what your role is in the entertainment industry. You know, you become a jack of all trades. So some other ways that Asia's at the digital cutting edge, monetize the consumer expression factor, especially in sort of, again, like I talked about, ringtones, ringback tones, but also in, you know, up you know, the encouraging the creation of user content and sort of monetizing that user content, picking the best user-created content and figuring out a way to market it, even in the face of piracy. So there you go, John. The convergence with other forms of online entertainment, like gaming, sort of being really aggressive and innovative in terms of how you market your music and generate revenues. Oh, okay.
Do you take a few last questions, or do you want to have a chance to wrap up yourself?
I'll just wrap up real quickly, and then if people have questions, we can talk sort of informally afterward. So, we talked about artists taking more control, moving straight to the deals with distributors. You know, this is another sort of way that I think Asia is really leading the pack in setting the standard in terms of where things are headed. And then when I say cultivating the hardcores, what I mean essentially is that what you want to do is recognize that, yeah, okay, piracy is out there, it's widespread, but there are, you know, if you can cultivate sort of a hardcore fan or a reasonable, you know, reasonably sized percentage of the market that is willing to pay for the product, then you can actually build a sustainable business model on those people. Now, for example, I mentioned Taihe, the company that signed. I had the picture there. That was I forgot to mention she was the American idol of China, you know, and they basically signed her. But essentially, what they are, you know, what they look how they look at it is they figure at best we can probably get about a third of our consumers, sort of our young digital, you know, consumers, netizens, to pay for content. We're never going to get the other 66% to pay for it. But we can build a business model off those one third. They're the ones who want the value adds. They're the ones who want the digital jacket included with the song, or they want the lyrics, or they want to enter contests that you know will maybe allow them to spend a weekend with their favorite artist or something like that.
Well, you're describing a long tail open source business model, and you'd see it. Red Hat, what they do, and in fact, there's a certain percentage of people that have a service and they have a support and the amenity.
Right,
and,
exactly.
And you can reach that segment, then you get a real business. Right? Yeah.
One concern with these business models, though, is that. Like I said, it's extremely hit-centric. I mentioned that before. And when you talk about long tail, actually, in this case, long tail, the long tail is left on the table in the sense that the artists, you know, are, you know, I mean, you have this sort of two-week window, and then you never promote the music again for the most part because you're sort of always going for the latest, you know, music that you can promote.
So the question I have is what does happen in the long tail? You've been talking about the tall head the whole time,
right.
And John
exactly.
Correctly observes that there is a long tail business model out here. I heard Reed Hastings, the head of Netflix, give a really interesting talk that were he said that the movies that are in the long tail are accounting now that. He's got the Netflix model, and shelf space isn't an issue. He's able to have an essentially infinite catalog, and he's finding that that the long tail is getting fatter, that people are renting a larger proportion of the unpopular movies. So the question begs, what happens out in the long tail? Inherently.
Yeah, well, and I think right now it's a rhetorical question in at least with regard to China. What happens with the long tail? I don't know. I mean, maybe it's the opportunity for the artists to step up, break away from the labels, and say, look, I've got this whole catalog of tunes, and I've got fans who want to support me with them, and you know, I'm going to go out and promote that myself. So maybe that's.
And China is a very long tail.
Yes. That's right. Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Talking about essentially. Sorry.
It's okay. Let's wrap so people can go and then stick around and ask the question.
Sure.
So, Eric, thank you so much.